Good morning, everyone. We're going to go ahead and open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. Thank you for being here on this Thursday. We have a number of bills that we have scheduled for a public hearing and possible work session, as well as a number of other bills that are set for work sessions. I will tell you that some of the ones that are set for work sessions are not actually going to be fully worked today. We will be opening work sessions on those to take care of certain information and business that we need to. But at this point, we're going to have to kind of work through this process. I have three counsel here, and we're going to be kind of going back and forth. I'm going to try to get them released so they can do their other duties. I also have two members that are here who want to give testimony, and what my plan is just open up those proceedings to take the testimony, and then we'll come back and take other public testimony. So with that, let me go ahead and start with opening the work session on 526, and the purpose for this is at this point is to take Senator Laurie Monison Anderson's comments.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. I'm State Senator Laurie Monison Anderson from the Gresham, Troutdale, Wood Village, Fairview, and a little bit of East Portland. I'm very excited about the amendments. I know that the fiscal, it was a huge issue, and a number of sections were taken out of the bill, which I am fine with, and we have ended up with the dash two or the dash three. I would prefer the dash threes because my original bill was to help victims of domestic violence and the children who have to witnesses. We did take out that portion on victimization of children, but the dash twos, if you... Since I'm a nurse and not an attorney, if you want to go with the dash twos, that is fine also. And that's really all I have to say.
All right. Well, thank you. We do not have all the fiscals, and I have to just get through this to see exactly what we're looking at. So I just want to get your comments on the record. Thank you very much.
Okay.
With that, I'm going to recess the work session on Senate Bill 526, and we're going to go ahead and open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 132A to take Senator Devlin's testimony.
And Chair Posadsky, members of the committee, House Bill 132A expands the crime of third-degree assault to include intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causing physical injury to health care providers in hospitals. It defines health care provider as a person who provides or assists in providing health care services in a hospital. The bill declares an emergency and is effective on passage.
All right. Thank you.
One small correction. It is a Senate bill.
Oh, excuse me. Senate Bill 132A.
Quite all right. It is Thursday. Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, Senator Richard Devlin, Senate District 19. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, do not actually consider the brevity of my testimony to be in any sense any indication that I do not strongly support this bill. I very strongly support this bill. SB 132A, which amends Oregon Revised Statutes 163.165 to add people working in hospitals to the list of professions who, if they are intentionally, knowingly, and recklessly assaulted while performing their jobs, will result in the crime being a Class C felony. ORS Chapter 163.165 currently includes professions who, like hospital employees, are required to serve all members of the public, such as emergency medical services personnel, youth correctional facility staff, public transit vehicle operators, and taxi drivers. Intentional violent acts against hospital staff occur despite extensive training of hospital employees about how to prevent violence as well as how to recognize and de-escalate potentially violent situations. Currently, 35 states, including the state of Washington, have taken action to enhance criminal penalties for assaults against hospital employees. SB 132, and I want to emphasize this, SB 132 does not remove any protections for mentally ill or impaired patients who may be violent but are unable to form criminal intent. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I think you were all here earlier this week when I was here, and I rarely appear before the Judiciary Committee. Some of the parties that were opposed to the bill we had before us when I was here before are here in support of this bill. So it's a case of someday your foe is your allies and someday the reverse. But This bill has about one of the strongest lists of supporters of any bill of this type in this session. It's supported by Legacy Health, the Oregon Health Sciences University, Peace Health, Salem Health, St. Charles Health System, the Oregon Nurses Association, the Oregon Emergency Nurses Association, Oregon College of Emergency Physicians, the Oregon Medical Association, and the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I know that this committee does not take lightly the enhancement of penalties for criminal acts, but I think in this particular case, given the circumstances, given the history of this issue, given the work that this and previous committees have done on this issue, if you look back at the 2007 legislation, which led to a lot of the reporting that we have now, led to a lot of the requirements in terms of training, the unfortunate aspect of this is we still see significant violence against hospital employees, nurses and others, orderlies. Which actually they are in an environment in which safety is a paramount issue. It's not only their safety, but it's the safety of the people that are in the facility themselves, some of them in some of their most vulnerable states. Ms. Chairman, I would encourage you to look at this issue carefully, and members of the committee. While I know that the committee has concerns about the cost of actually increasing criminal penalties, I think that this is a modest cost if we can do anything to control the level of violence, which is very inappropriate and actually somewhat growing, not somewhat, more than growing, in our healthcare facilities. So, Mr. Chairman, I would urge your support. There will be people that will testify after me when you reopen the hearing that are far more knowledgeable in the area than I am, but I do appreciate this opportunity.
Thank you. Questions or comments? Senator Devlin, I'm going to just put this on the record for all those. I did meet with Paul Cosgrove, who's one of the lobbyists working this issue. I have a lot of concerns at this point based on what I think is going to be the impact on this into the system, into the prison system, as to the cost, as to the broadness. It appears that the Dash 2s or the, I think it's the Dash 2s, it may have been the Dash 1s, whatever one that we have before us, seems to expand the population that's even covered from what it was originally. So we will take and definitely be deliberate about it. We will give it a sincere looking as to exactly what we can or can't afford, knowing with the impacts that we have with House Bill 3194, as to what the agreements were made in that scenario as to increasing new crimes and penalties. We will look at it, and we'll look at it very seriously over the next couple of weeks that we have to take these things in consideration.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you. All right. With that, I'm going to go ahead and recess the public hearing at this point on Senate Bill 132A. And before I hit the gavel, I made my statements because I want those who will be testifying coming up understanding where the chair is at this point so you can maybe address some of my concerns. So that, with that, we're recessing that public hearing. And at this point, we're going to go open up a work session on Senate Bill 405. Laura?
Yes, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Senate Bill 405 came to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary for the Oregon Law Commission. We have no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact on this bill. We do currently have a subsequent referral to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means, and I've drafted a letter in case you would like to remove that today. We had a previous public hearing on this on March 24th, and at that time we discussed the proposed Dash 2 amendments. So Senate Bill 4, the proposed Dash 2 amendments make minor changes to ORS 419A.255 to correct unintended consequences of recent changes to the law.
All right. So at this point, what we need to be doing is adopting the Dash 2s and then removing the subsequent referral. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Senator Cruz?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendment to Senate Bill 405.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 2 amendments for Senate Bill 405 into the bill. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 405 as amended by the Dash 2 amendments to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation and request the subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means be removed.
Senator Cruz now moves Senate Bill 405 as amended by the Dash 2 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation and also requesting that the subsequent referral to Ways and Means be withdrawn. Any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Cruz, will you carry 405?
Okay.
And we'll close that work session. We're going to go ahead and open up a work session. I saw I missed you on Senate Bill 360.
Sure. Yes, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 360 came to us at the request of the Senate Interim Committee on Judiciary. We have no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on this bill. We previously heard about it in a public hearing on February 25th. At that time, we received a lot of testimony. There was great discussion. And to follow up, we held a work group on March 17th to further discuss moving forward. And I think there are a few folks here today that might want to make some comments on this bill.
Yeah, we've scheduled this work session for these comments so we can kind of go forward as to where the work group came. So let's see. Alex, you're here. Who else is here?
Sean.
Sean, thank you. I just wasn't looking around. If y'all would be so kind to come forward and bring us up to date as to where the work group ended up concluding.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Alex Kyler. I'm Lane County's Intergovernmental Relations Manager. I think you recall the bill, as introduced, would have amended the seller's disclosure list for real estate transactions to add a section alerting a potential buyer that they would be moving within proximity of a mining site. So zoned under Goal 5 land use laws in Oregon, where we did have a work session. I think the point of the bill was really to try to increase the educational sort of environment for folks who are purchasing real estate, especially in rural parts of Oregon, that the butte that they're looking at may or may not be subject to mining in the future. We got together with the realtors, the aggregate producers, the home builders, and we had a good meeting. And Ogami, the agency, was there. Essentially, we've agreed to a web-based platform from each of our entities that will be more clear as to sort of alerting potential buyers of real estate in Oregon about the nature of mining and how that especially relates to land use laws that some sites are set aside for these purposes. So we're writing up an informal agreement among the parties, and it was, from my perspective, a good outcome for this measure.
All right, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Sean Jillians representing the Oregon Association of Realtors. I would echo Alex's comments. We are committed as the Realtor Association to putting in our advisories that we put out for prospective purchasers a section on mine sites and quarries, and we've actually even started working on the language for that. So I think that's something that will be up soon. We'll also have links not only to Dogami's website but also guiding people to their particular county as well. If we could get to that point for sort of informational, we're also committed to working on education to real estate licensees. Now that this issue is going to be in our advisory, that's also put forward by the real estate agency as well. So I think we're actually going to hit a broader swath than we would have otherwise. And thank you for your leadership on this issue.
All right, well, thank you. Before you all leave, Rich, I see you're in the back. Did you want to make any comments?
Good morning, Rich Angstrom, president of the Oregon Concrete Aggregate Producers Association. I think this is a good resolution. It'll increase the communication to the sellers. The one thing we do need to work on, I think, in the future is how the counties actually protect the mine sites that from the encroachment of development, which kind of has led to the problem that we're trying to address now. That's kind of the outstanding issue. We have a couple of bills moving forward this session to increase communications between the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and the counties, and then this issue with the sellers. But the root issue still remains that once a site's permitted, it's on an inventory, the counties are responsible to protect that mine site from encroachments. and they're not, and so we're seeing the development come in around these mine sites, and that's kind of the last piece I think at some point we need to think about. It's going to take some more noodling, but this was a good resolution on this issue.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you all for, one, coming forward and putting the presentation that you did today, but also, more importantly, getting together as a work group and actually working this out. And Senator Cruz and I were just saying it's really nice when we actually have a bill that we don't have to move forward and we actually have the parties taking care of this where we don't have to add to the statutes. So thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So for that purpose, we're going to go ahead and close the work session on Senate Bill 360. And Laura, I think the last one you have is Senate Bill 604.
That is correct, sir.
And we'll open up the work session on that bill.
So, Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 604 is sponsored by the Committee on Judiciary. We have no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact on this bill, and we held a public hearing on March 18th. We do have the proposed Dash 7 amendments before us today. Now, those amendments combine changes that were made in the Dash 1, 2, 3, 5, and 6 amendments. Previously discussed the bill, which incorporates the 2008 Uniform Interstate Family Support Act amendments into Oregon law.
All right.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 7 amendment to Senate Bill 604.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 7 amendment for Senate Bill 604. Discussion or comments? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 604 as amended by the Dash 7 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 604 as amended by the Dash 7s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And Senator Gelser, do you feel comfortable carrying
sure.
this one? That would be great. Thank you. With that, we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 604. And Laura, have we taken care of
that? Yes, correct. Thank
all
you.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we're going to go back up. And Eric, you have, it looks like only.
You've got 350, Senate Bill 350.
350 only, right?
That's correct.
All right, so we're going to go and open up the public hearing on Senate Bill 350. Go ahead.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 350 comes from the Senate Interim Judiciary Committee. The bill requires two Multnomah County judges to hold court in Gresham. The proposed Dash 1 amendment replaces the measure. Currently, when a party files a motion to disqualify a judge, there are two sets of timelines to do so. For populations 100,000 or less, you have 10 days to file the motion. For populations over 100,000, you have to make the motion at the time of the assignment. The amendment authorizes counties with a population between 100,000 and 200,000 to elect which set of timelines they want to use by local court rule.
All right. Well, thank you. I'm going to let Senator Cruz start off with comments as to the bill itself, the amendment.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The amendment, it came to me from Douglas County, where the public defender said we needed to do something because the population had increased over the level, and they were still doing the 10 days based on an agreement they had with the court. And so the request was, could we make it legal? Okay. And so basically, and then the chair was, in his brilliance, said, well, let's make it optional for those counties so they can go either way. But quite honestly, this was just an attempt to make a practice that's been going on in Douglas County forever still legal in Douglas County, because it's really the way it needs to work in small counties.
Yeah, well, thank you. And the reason that we took this approach and making it optional, we know that there's other counties that fall within this framework right. that may have already made the change. We did not want to force them to have to go back to right. a system that they had removed themselves from. And so this will leave the flexibility in there for those counties within that population base to be able to transition and work through and still have a requirement at the upper end of 200,000 plus. So I think between the two of us, we feel that's comfortable.
We do, Ms. Chair, and I'd also say that the judge who made the agreement is Judge Garrison, who's a personal friend, and I would just soon have him do legal things. So.
Yeah, he does well there, and we want to keep him.
Yes.
All right, so there was no one that signed up for Senate Bill 350. I do want to ask if there's anyone here knowing what the Dash 1 amendment does, if anyone wanted to give comment on it. If not, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing and go to work session. With that, we'll close the public hearing, open our work session on Senate Bill 350. Senator Cruz?
Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to Senate Bill 350.
Senator Cruz moves the Dash 1 amendment for Senate Bill 350. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 350 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz now moves Senate Bill 350 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Objections? Not seeing any. So ordered. Senator Cruz, will you carry this one?
Be happy to. Thank you.
All right. And Senator Cruz will be the carrier. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 350. Eric, I think that takes care of you.
Yes. Thank you.
You bet. And so now we're going to go. You want to go back to the one?
Yeah, that makes sense.
All right. So we're going to reopen the public hearing we started on Senate Bill 132A to continue taking public testimony. And at this point, we have... see. I've got, well, no, looks like that person's off.
We've got Andreas Linus, too.
Okay. Why don't we, Dr. Mike Newcomb, why don't you and Bill, is it Schuler? Schuler. Why don't you two first come up and we'll take your testimony. I appreciate that. And then we have a couple other proponents that we'll bring up as a second panel. Oh, we got three. Oh.
And Mr. Chair, if I just may introduce Dr. Newcomb.
Yes, you may. Sorry, Paul.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Paul Cosgrove representing Legacy Health, and I'd like to introduce Dr. Mike Newcomb. This bill has come from Legacy Health because its employees have been deeply affected by this problem, but as you heard from Senator Devlin, all the health systems around the state have the similar problem. And Dr. Newcomb can explain to you how he sees it from his perspective as the chief operating officer of Legacy Health, and then Bill is the director of emergency nurses and has a different perspective, well, not a different perspective, but an additional perspective. So with that, and I'm happy to be here to answer questions about the chair's comments about the fiscal impact and some of those aspects of the bill.
Okay, thank you. Gentlemen, who'd like to go first?
I think I'll step up first. Senator Pozanski, members of the committee. First of all, this is the best voice I can muster today, so please excuse it. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on behalf of Senate Bill 132. Violent acts against hospital workers by patients...
Doctor, I needed to put your name on the record.
Excuse me. I'm Everett W. Newcomb III. Go by Mike Newcomb.
Thank you.
Chief Operating Officer for Legacy Health. Violent acts against hospital workers by patients, family members, and other visitors have been increasing steadily over the past several years in many hospitals, not only throughout Oregon, but quite frankly, across the country. In the six hospitals operated by Legacy Health, we've seen increases in violent acts against our employees at all of our facilities, but particularly our urban facilities, Legacy Good Samaritan Hospital and Legacy Emmanuel Hospital. The most common location is in the emergency departments. However, violence in the workplace has occurred in many locations throughout our facilities. We have taken many steps in preventing violence, including increasing both the number of security officers and their 24/7 presence throughout our campuses, but most particularly in the emergency departments, increasing the number of security cameras, secure access doors, improving patient flows to reduce wait times, which can cause irritation on the part of patients. And most importantly, ongoing training for our employees on techniques to recognize potentially violent behavior and specific techniques to de-escalate a potentially dangerous situation. Yet despite all of these efforts, violence against our healthcare workers continues on an all too frequent basis. Like firefighters and emergency medical services personnel, hospital workers by law cannot refuse to see, evaluate, and treat patients who may be behaving in a belligerent or potentially dangerous manner. Under the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, or EMTALA, hospital workers are required to evaluate and treat everyone who presents for care in our facilities. We simply cannot walk away. Senate Bill 132 makes assault of a hospital worker a Class C felony, just as it is today for ambulance personnel, or for that matter, taxi drivers. We support this bill for one very simple reason. namely that hospital workers, whose sole mission is to provide care and comfort to those who are ill and injured, be given the same protection under the law as is provided to operators of public transit vehicles, workers in correction facilities, emergency medical service personnel, and the aforementioned taxi drivers. Once again, I'd like to thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today of this critically important bill. I would be more than happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Thank you, sir. Bill, why don't you go next?
Sure. Chair Brzezinski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. My name is Bill Schuler. I'm an emergency nurse in the Portland area, and I'm also the immediate past president of the Oregon Emergency Nurses Association. Thank you for allowing me time to address you today. Violence in healthcare is a pretty rampant problem, not only here in Oregon, but nationwide. The Bureau of Labor Statistics shows that violence in healthcare is about almost four times the rate of violence in any business in the private sector. And it is climbing, as recent data has shown. It's been well shown that violence in healthcare is underreported, so we expect that the true rate of violence is probably much higher. The Emergency Nurses Association's own Emergency Department Violence Surveillance Study showed that 55% of those nurses that were surveyed in the last week had experienced physical and or verbal assault. To date, as was previously stated by Senator Devlin, 35 states have similar enhanced penalties for those who assault healthcare workers. And this year, California, Colorado, Massachusetts, South Dakota are considering similar legislation. We in the emergency department must take care of everybody that comes through our doors. We don't have a choice, just like Dr. Everett, Dr. Newcomb said. My colleague, who's in the room, just mentioned an analogy for that would be like taking the healthcare team or the nurse and putting them in the car with the drunk driver. When you look at violence that way, it lets you know that sometimes we have minimal to almost no control. We've been hurt, we have bled, we have been broken. We simply ask that those who would intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly cause harm to hospital workers be held accountable for their behavior. A couple of stories, and I submitted some written testimony that you can read their testimonies, but one nurse last year, working in the emergency department, had her arm broken by a patient and her face bruised. I got to attend the sentencing of the attacker, the assailant, and she had her crime was a misdemeanor. It got bumped up to a felony. The only reason why was because her child was in the room witnessing the violence. Now, her sentence was 5 years of probation. And there's another testimony of Chuck Westland. He was struck by a patient after he was in the emergency department for being intoxicated. He was sober, and the patient attacked him, hit him in the head. He suffered a concussion. Also, it interrupted his equilibrium for quite a while. If you read his testimony, he says, I was 100 days off of work. Couldn't work for 100 days. My assailant only got 10 days in jail. And he also lost 20% of his body weight. Assaults on hospital employees are frightening. They're debilitating. And in some cases, they're career-ending. They interrupt the entire healthcare process. They affect the safety of the patients as well as the staff. And they come with a great price of apprehension, guilt, fear, and pain. We've heard the excuses. It's part of your job. What did you expect? Oh, the DA is not going to prosecute. However, we want and we know that it's not acceptable for people to go unpunished for their bad actions, especially against people who are trying to help. Washington State has a similar law, and as the hospital systems that were presented that are in support of this bill, many of them have hospitals in Washington State, and they also have hospitals in Oregon State. So the employees in Washington State have felony protection, while employees in Oregon do not. We're working on our end to decrease violence in healthcare with awareness, education, and training, but we need your help. And the over 600 members of the Oregon Emergency Nurses Association ask that you allow Senate Bill 132 to move forward. I thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great. Thank you. Questions? Senator Thatcher first.
I guess my only question is, since these other states have what you call felony protections, do they have fewer attacks on medical staff?
That's a great question, Senator Thatcher. And actually, the National Emergency Nurses Association is trying to gather that data. We don't have good data on that currently.
So, Bill, let's kind of start with the felony stuff. I've been a prosecutor for now close to 30 years, and it just seems like everyone thinks that because you got a felony, you're going to get, something of significance. I asked counsel to pull up our sentencing guidelines, and sentencing guidelines is how people are sentenced in this state on basically felonies. Mm-hmm. I mean, you also misdemeanors, and you track. An assault three at this point is a classification is a six, and to get to where you're going to prison the first time, you would have to have four or more adult non-person misdemeanors. So the first example you gave us, it sounds like that is felonies. So you take the first example you gave us where the person was placed on probation in on a misdemeanor, which is a class A. I got that right. I think it was a Class A misdemeanor, and they had 5 years of probation. That's the longest period of probation that a court can enter for a misdemeanor. So they're under the court's jurisdiction for 5 years. Normally, they also would, and I would assume, now maybe this wasn't, I'm not sure where this occurred, there would be a jail sentence that would have been imposed as well. Now, I don't know if that happened or not, because I don't know what court. I can tell you where I practice, it would have been almost automatically that they would have had some type of sanction in the jail. The jail under a misdemeanor is a year, up to a year. Mm-hmm. So I don't want you to be here thinking that if we make this a felony, everyone's going to be going into a correctional facility, because that's not how our sentencing guidelines work. One of the things I've asked counsel to do is to look at the 35 different states. Let's see exactly what they say is a felony or how they've enhanced it. We have in this state have taken the opportunity where we think that we need to increase the sanctions, where it's shown that it's necessary, to maybe use within our misdemeanor system but enhance the penalties that are above and beyond. So we've done that. So I'm here to try to tell you we're going to work through this and see what we can do. The other part that I am concerned, and Doctor, you may want to also respond to this. My reading of the amendment looks like the population that's covered by this bill is greater than what the original. It looks like almost anyone who works in the hospital is covered as compared to the ER as setting. And that also makes some concern because, as Bill has said, in the last week or whenever they did the reporting, 55% of the staff said they've had some type of either verbal or physical caution. I have to, as the chair, look at what we're trying to do in trying to maintain the prison population. And so I know there are people, because I've done ride-alongs, and we've seen where there are definitely, let's say, the frequent flyers that come into the ER who are the ones that are probably our problem children of more so that have a lot of these past criminal histories that are going to push them into prison term. And I've looked at the physical. The physical's, from my perspective, is high. I don't think it's as high as it really should be based on what we think the reporting would be or could be. And then I think the other part is the you have intentional, knowingly, or recklessly. And the recklessly is another one that's concerning because it's pretty broad as to how that is applied. So those are the concerns I have, and I want to put all this out on the table so everyone knows where we're at, and we're going to do the best we can to work through this. So that's my comments. Would anyone like to respond?
Could I just take a shot at three of those, sir?
Please.
First of all, this really doesn't just apply to the emergency department. So you're right, it does expand to cover people in the hospital outside of just the emergency department, and certainly more than just the emergency room nurses. Food service workers, housekeepers who walk into a patient's room can and have been assaulted in our hospitals. And it can happen anywhere in the hospital, not just in the emergency department. So, yes, it does provide coverage for more than just emergency room personnel. Secondly, it was very interesting what you said about the sentencing guidelines for Class C felonies, and indeed, often they don't result in prison time, which to my mind is fine and should reduce the cost of including this population of people into this bill. As you know, as a prosecutor, very often it depends on the severity of the act, the nature of the act, the nature of the circumstances that surround the act as to what the judge is or isn't and what the prosecutor is or isn't going to ask for as far as sentencing goes. So I think that, you know, to say that all of these people may go to prison may be overstating the actual cost of what this addition to this bill would be. I do, however, think that by adding hospital workers into this bill, it does provide that same level of protection under the law that are afforded other people who, like we said earlier, just simply can't walk away. Firefighters, EMS workers, they have to attend to the problem, as do hospital workers. So it's the only comments that I would have. I think your questions and concerns are very good, and certainly things that need to be considered, and I appreciate that. But I do think that there are mitigating circumstances as to why we believe that this is very, very important, and it should not lead to a huge increase in cost for the state of Oregon.
Right, thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may address the issue of what happened in the amendment in Health Care Committee. Senator Cruz may recall, but the record is pretty clear that and I'll step back. When you submit a bill to legislative council and then there's a drafting process, some things get changed. And in this particular case, we submitted it calling for coverage of all health workers, which in our mind was everyone in the hospital. It came out with health care workers who have licenses. That's the original bill as introduced, Senate Bill 132. And we worked diligently and successfully with Legislative Council to find an amendment within the existing relating clause, which was drafted rather narrowly, not by us but by Legislative Council, to make sure that it covered all hospital workers. But the testimony in the health care committee by all parties, from SEIU to AFSCME to all of the parties, ONA and OMA, was this was intended, always intended by us, and we worked to get an amendment to make it so, to cover all hospital workers. And that's because, as Dr. Newcomb mentioned, it doesn't have to be somebody who has a license or a certification from the state who is the victim. All of those people are required to do their jobs in order to deliver health care, and we believe they all should have the same degree of protection, not just someone who has a medical degree or a nursing degree. But if somebody is a cafeteria worker or a housekeeping person that's assaulted, we believe they should be equally treated. With respect to the fiscal, in reviewing the fiscal impact statement, as you know, it's difficult to estimate fiscal impact of these kinds of things. I recognize you have to deal with that issue in all of these kinds of bills. I note that the LFO made the fiscal impact based on data that we supplied. And what we did is we took all of the incidents of both verbal and physical violence and narrowed those down in our five Oregon campuses to the ones in which there was severe injury, significant injury of the kind that Bill mentioned. And those were six cases in a calendar year in Legacy's five hospitals, including two of the biggest hospitals in the state. So it's a relatively good part of the sampling of what would happen in other hospitals. And that's what LFO based those on. And they came up, as you know, with an estimate that there might be 20 people annually who would be covered by this enhanced penalty based on our data that there were six in our hospitals, and that of those, five would end up in the Department of Corrections, some would end up in county jails for the reasons that you've stated and how the system works, and that a number of them would end up with probation. So that's how I think that that's probably a realistic estimate. You would know better than I how the sentencing guidelines affects all of that. But they started with 20 cases a year statewide that might be covered under this. And we think that's probably realistic. It is not very many cases, and it doesn't cover all the violence that happens in hospitals. There are Alzheimer's patients who would not be affected by this, who lash out and hurt people. This isn't intended to cover those and wouldn't cover those folks. They're people with mental impairments who also can cause injury. That's not intended. These are people who intentionally or knowingly or with reckless disregard for what they're doing hurt people. And they're often, as I've mentioned to you in our meeting, drug seekers who we don't give them the drugs they're seeking. and they lash out.
All right, thank you very much. I have another couple of panels I need to take, so
yeah,
thank you all
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Chair.
So I have Joe Bessler and Andrea Salinas.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name is Joe Basler. I work for Oregon AFSCME. Sorry about that. We represent about 24,000 members around the state, and this bill sort of we take an interest mainly because of our largest local, which is OHSU, over almost over 5,000 members, and also one of our smallest, Good Shepherd Hospital, out in Hermiston. I don't have a lot to add from my testimony that's on OLIS from the last committee. Our members were very interested in this bill. In fact, we've been talking about it for a while. We were less focused on it. We weren't ready to move forward on our own, so it was really nice to see the hospitals moving forward on this. To your question, Senator Przanski, about the expanded nature of how this, I think, works is a key point for our folks, because we see the reason why we started talking about it, we would see EMS folks have the extra protection, but as soon as you got into the emergency room, that felt like our workers there would feel like it went away. And so when we started talking about it with Mr. Cosgrove, it was very important to us to make sure that one section of our folks in the emergency room weren't protected, or in the hospital were protected and weren't. We didn't want to keep those different levels. Everybody has to do their job, and we want to make sure everyone was protected. So that's all I really have to add. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the contract lobbyist for SEIU Local 49. SEIU Local 49 represents over 6,000 hospital workers and clinic workers in Oregon. Over the years, we've seen healthcare workers take on assaults as part of their everyday jobs and way of life, but getting injured as a result of these violent acts should not be a normal way of life for our workers. SB 132 does help protect workers from violence that is knowingly committed, and we believe this will serve as a deterrent for these offenders. The bill doesn't include, nor should it include, people who suffer from mental illness. We realize that this is a problem, and it doesn't include those who use drugs or alcohol. We know that the lack of community treatment has increased those who suffer from these illnesses, and those patients are frequently seen in the ER, and oftentimes they can present as violent patients. And because of the failure to treat the root causes of their illnesses, we do see them in the ER. But we strongly believe that the legislature and health systems should continue to resolve these issues. But what we're talking about here today is very different. We know that some of our healthcare workers have experienced violence from patients who had full mental capacity to know better. And because of the nature of the crimes committed against healthcare workers, we believe that this law will only be used a handful of times throughout the year. And we believe that it really will act as a deterrent for that aggressive, violent behavior. And for this, we would like for you to pass SB 132.
All right. Thank you. I'm going to start off because the last panel said this. I didn't say anything then. We just checked. The bill doesn't exclude individuals that have mental health issues, Alzheimer's, or any type of other type of scenarios outright from the bill. Those are defenses. Those are what the defense would raise, that they shouldn't be held accountable because they didn't have this. That doesn't mean that they're not going to be in charged with the crime. So I want to make certain, again, that everyone understands that this is basically just taking a new population, sticking it into the Assault 3, and there's no carve-outs as to people's mental state or anything like that. So this is the magnitude of what we're looking at. We're just basically saying, for if it's an assault on one of these hospital workers, you're going to be charged with a higher offense than what you currently are, and it does not give carve-outs for people's mental capacity on the front end of them not being charged. They may be able to have a defense, meaning that they may not be held accountable because of their mental state, but it doesn't say that they're not going to be charged with the crime. All right. Other questions or comments? Thank you all very much. Gail, you're on here, so why don't you come forward. Is there anyone else who wants to give testimony today on Senate Bill 132A? And, Gail?
Thank you. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. This debate has occurred over on the House side for the last several sessions, and it's risen in a different context, but it's a similar discussion. In 2013-2014, the hospital workers at Oregon State Hospital were requesting similarly that if an assault, a misdemeanor assault, were to occur against a state hospital worker, that it would automatically be elevated up to a felony status. Those bills are actually not as broad as is Senate Bill 132. They entailed only intentional and knowing behavior. This bill, 132, does also pick up recklessly, which is what the chair's already offered. I think the more I've listened to the testimony from the proponents, I think there's a real misunderstanding as to why the existing elevators for certain kind of people exists. And I've listened to those debates that have occurred over on the House side, and they're very different from the ones that are being offered by the proponents here. Proponents here are saying that they're looking at the existing elevators for public transit people, Oregon Youth Authority, EMTs, taxis, and those are, they conclude from that that, quote, these are people that cannot refuse to treat the public. But that really is not the rationale that was used when those bills were passed and introduced initially over on the House side. It was because those persons were in vulnerable physical positions and were not in a position to be able to protect their vulnerability. It started first with the taxi drivers. Taxi drivers were alone in the car. They were contending that they were being hit from the backside, and their entire job required them to be solely focused on the forward motion. And so the taxi industry first came in and said, we want to put up a sign in the car that says, you assault a taxi driver, it's a felony. And they felt that that notice right there in the screen between the back seat and the front would act as the deterrent. Second in came the TriMet bus drivers. They were alleging the same thing. We're sitting there, we're in a vulnerable position, people come up behind us and they whack us. We also want to have a sign right there on that screen behind the driver that says, you hit a TriMet driver, you're going to have a sign right there that says that'll be a felony. Third coming in were the EMT workers. EMT workers were saying, we are down on the ground, focused on an individual on the ground. Our back is exposed. We're not supposed to be looking at our backside. We're in the middle of a volatile situation. Often there's no police presence yet at the scene. We're exposed. They were the first one that got the elevator from misdemeanor to felony without, quote, a sign being present that would warn someone, if you assault me, it's going to be a felony. But the argument was, we are inherently vulnerable, being down on the ground, being like that, and we're not looking at our backside. Fourth to come in was the Oregon Youth Authority workers. And there was a video clip of an Oregon Youth Authority worker that they're very much open into the general population there at the Oregon Youth Authority population. And they're supposed to be mingling with the folk. And what happened was one kid just simply was sitting there in a gymnasium, and he just simply got, for reasons unagitated, just got off his chair, went over and whacked the backside of an OIA worker. And so they came in and said, we are inherently vulnerable. And if you make it a felony, the kids in the OIA facility will get the message, you hit one of us, it's a felony. So in that instance, we could understand the rationale. Elevating it to a felony will at least be a deterrent because that's a closed, confined environment. And then the other elevator that's present in our statute is children under 10. And I think the argument for there is they're just inherently vulnerable. So the debate now with respect to state hospital workers that erupted in 13 and 14, and then now with hospital workers in general with this bill, are making conclusions here that all of those existing elevators are because they're unable to refuse to treat the public. But that has not been the rationale. There's a lot of groups of people who are unable to refuse to treat the public. That's true of public teachers. That's true of mailmen. That's true of librarians. That's true of parking lot attendants. It's true of public defenders. There's a lot of subgroups of individuals out there in society who are not at liberty to filter out who they deal with and who they don't. So I think that there's a misgiving as to why the current elevators exist. Quite frankly, sitting there watching these elevators get added into the Assault 3 statute just about every session, it's easy to conclude it becomes almost a status. If them, why not me? And the first thing I would ask is, well, why not domestic violence victims? They're in confined closed quarters, and they don't have security down the hallway. So who gets to have the status of going next just because of who they are? The original calibration of the assault statutes as listed in the 1971 Commission to Revise the Criminal Code divided up the degree of felony statutes from B misdemeanor of offensive physical contact to physical injury to serious physical injury based on the degree of harm, the weapon used, and the mental state of the person acting, not the status of the individual. And the proponents here simply want to say, because of our status, we get felony treatment. I submit to the committee, many people can come in and allege the same thing. So with respect to some of the other problems with the bill, these will be very protracted, difficult cases to prosecute, and they will be expensive to defend. The defense will immediately want to know, what sort of mental state was the defendant in? How agitated was the defendant? And secondly, what drugs were in their system? They could have had street drugs coming into the ER, or they could be coming out of surgery with prescribed given drugs in their system. But the defense is going to have to load up with expert witness testimony, and all of the witnesses are going to be licensed or workers from the hospital, so everyone will have to take time off to come on in. So I would also observe what's already been discussed. Generally, these are going to be people who are not at their best, and they are going to have impaired mental states. They can have alcohol and drug issues. They can have mental problems, and those are all very protracted defenses that will have to be litigated. I would also submit there's no deterrent here. And we had this discussion when this was down in healthcare. In contrast to an OIA facility, which is a closed environment where the word can get out, you hit somebody, it's a felony, you're not going to have that in a hospital setting. If someone's prosecuted for a felony in the emergency room in month one, somebody up in oncology in month three isn't going to know about that. So there isn't a closed environment within a hospital where the word can travel. You hit somebody, it's going to be a felony. Two more points. In the testimony before the healthcare committee, before it came over here to judiciary, there was an acknowledgement. I was asking myself, well, what's not working? Are they prosecuting now? And there was acknowledgement from the proponents, they're not very good at reporting now. And a lot of them felt it was no good to report now because it was a misdemeanor. And they would report more regularly if there was a felony. And if it were a felony, then something would be different. And it was our conclusion that just bumping something up in this code doesn't change behavior out there in the street that easily. Lastly, I would agree with the comments previously made. Many people, often it drives the bargain at the trial court level, recognize that a judge on a misdemeanor has a lot more control over the length of probation, the conditions of probation, and the amount of time served in jail than does a judge on a felony that's a C felony at level six. Happy to answer any questions.
All right. Questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on Senate Bill 132A. And I want to thank everyone that has come forward to give us testimony today and their perspectives. All right, we're going to go ahead and looking at what we've got. So I'm going to go ahead and open up Senate Bill 557 because I'm not sure we have a whole lot that you're going to give. I don't think we had anyone sign up on that one. All right, so we'll go ahead and go with 557.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 557 comes to us from Senator Gelser. The bill amends the statute regarding the justifiable use of physical force for the purposes of criminal prosecution. It removes language concerning an incompetent person, declares an emergency, and is effective on passage. There are no amendments to the bill.
All right. Senator Gelser?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 557 simply corrects outdated language in this exception language. People who are incompetent, who are deemed incompetent, tend to be have people responsible for them that are guardians, or they may be in a group home or a foster home. These behaviors, this use of force outside of an imminent risk of physical injury, are not allowed. That is defined as abuse. So this is inconsistent with the rules that guardians and caretakers must follow. The law still would allow, when someone was in danger, to apply force to stop someone from running into a street, to stop someone from harming themselves or others. If you look back to 161.200, this applies to all people. It's an exception if the conduct is necessary as an emergency measure to avoid an imminent public or private injury. The threatened injury is of such gravity that, according to ordinary standards of intelligence and morality, the desirability and urgency of avoiding the injury clearly outweigh the desirability of avoiding the injury sought to be prevented. So that those would still remain in place. Finally, this language is very, very old. It's no longer consistent with the rights of people that have disabilities or elderly people to use the word discipline for adults. There are not adults that are that should be disciplined. Is it? I am a guardian. I no longer have the legal right to discipline my adult child because he is considered an adult. Therefore, it's inconsistent that I would be allowed to use physical force against him that would otherwise be criminal in order to discipline him. And that's all that this does.
Okay. So I had the sign-up sheet earlier. We made a change because it had written on there 357, and because it had 357 instead of 557, I'm like certain there's no one here today that wanted to give testimony on Senate Bill 557. All right, not seeing that, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. Thank you for the comments. We'll look into this for a future time. All right. So with that, that brings us to Senate Bill 743. And Jeff?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 743 comes to us from Senator Boquist. The bill allows a public safety officer's manager or supervisor to have a representative present during a non-criminal investigation of the officer. The bill defines impeachment list and revises the definition of just cause. It prohibits the disclosure of information gained from an investigation of an officer unless the disclosure is required under criminal discovery statutes. Lastly, the bill prohibits the use of a number of citations issued for the purpose of evaluating an officer. We do have proposed Dash 1 amendments before us that came after our last public hearing on this. The amendments remove provisions regarding quotas and the disclosure of information.
All right. Thank you. So I have Kevin Campbell listed as a wanting to give testimony. Is there anyone else besides Kevin who wants to give testimony today? Mike, why don't you all both come up then? And Kevin, why don't you start, please?
Great. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. I'm here today to express some concerns about the bill. I do and have reviewed the Dash 1 amendments. They are an improvement in our mind to the original bill. And so I'll try to make these comments very quick and specific. First of all, I want to mention that during this last year, there's been an active conversation, a Brady work group that involved nearly 40 members, including the wide range of participants. Labor had 7 representatives in that group. We had everybody from the state bar, DAs, local police agencies, judges, Department of Justice. The product of that was a series of protocols for DAs in terms of how they address issues related to officers, which DAs have to provide to the defense exculpatory information that could benefit the defense. There are law requirements with regard to what DAs need to tell the defense about potential witnesses, and in the case of police officers, that's typically called a Brady letter. It's a letter issued by the district attorney to the police department indicating that an officer, for a number of established reasons, has issues that have to be communicated to the defense, and often then that puts their veracity, the veracity of their testimony in question. And so the challenge here is it's not bright line. It's a very difficult environment in which to make these determinations, and it's all around issues related to the truthfulness of an officer. And of course, you can imagine that's a wide range from, wow, outright blatant deception, all the way down to you said something, lied about something that didn't make any, I mean, why would you lie about that, right? So those from serious down, and at some point that becomes a Brady obligation, and the DA needs to report it. So we went through this long work group process, and actually the protocols that came out of that are significant, and I will send the committee that, but it was an impressive group that worked very hard to address some of these issues. Now, specifically to the bill, this creates a definition in the first part of the bill related to an impeachment list. And I assume this is a list of those officers for which a Brady letter has been issued. That's my assumption there. DAs, some, I believe, probably do keep a list of these officers, others do not. I don't know if this definition would include actually the letter itself. That's a question I had about the definition. Down below it, in line 15, it talks about a definition of just cause, and it suggests that the term just cause doesn't mean unproven allegations resulting in placement on an impeachment list. And I'm not sure what that means. In order for information to be exculpatory, has to be turned over to the defense. That's not lightly taken, and DAs don't issue those letters lightly. They don't want to have to issue those letters. In the case where they do, I'm not sure what constitutes an unproven allegation. In the terminology of the bill, if you look down on line 17, throughout the bill, it adds the term supervisor or manager to the term public safety officer. In doing that, it seems to add it in some places and not add it in others. I'm not sure why the addition of supervisor or manager is necessary based on the definition of a public safety officer that appears on line 17 on page 1, because any sworn officer would be included in that definition, including a supervisor or a manager. The problem that's created when you add supervisor or manager to other provisions within the bill is that it changes potentially the meaning if you add it in some places and not in others. If I can take you to line 7 on page 2, the language there indicates that it appears to indicate, by adding supervisor or manager, it goes on to indicate that it's an officer potentially that can pick the representative for the supervisor or manager. I assume that's just a language problem and was not intentional. If you look at the next provision, line 9, page 2, there it doesn't include the addition of supervisor or manager, so it seems to indicate in the provision there, which requires that no more than two interviewers at a time may question a public safety officer, it seems now not to apply to a supervisor or manager. And I don't know why we would want to create that difference from one officer to another. So I'm not really sure if the addition of those words is necessary at all. I don't believe it is, because I think any sworn officer is covered by the definition at the top. And then the last point, and then I'll be done, and I appreciate the time here. I'm trying to catch up with this, frankly, at the last minute, and so I apologize. At the bottom of page 2, two provisions are eliminated and one remains. And the one that remains indicates that an employer may not use evidence that a public safety officer has been placed on an impeachment list for the purpose of other investigations or disciplinary action. And I'd just like to clarify here that generally when a police department believes there's reason to let the district attorney know that an officer potentially has an issue that would represent exculpatory or evidence that would benefit the defense, they have to communicate that to the DA. The DA would review it, and if they determined that's true, they would then have to communicate that to the defense, and that would constitute probably a Brady letter. In this case, this seems to indicate that, look, if you're on that list, that being on a list alone is not a reason to do other investigations or other disciplinary action. And I just want to clarify that whether you're an officer on a Brady list or not on a Brady list, if there is an external reason to do an investigation, some issue has come up which requires a department to investigate, obviously this is saying it's not the impeachment list that begins that. If you're on an impeachment list, that's not a reason to look further. I just want to make sure this doesn't create a situation where, independent of a list, there's an issue that has to be investigated related to an officer, that this would not somehow be confused as preventing that. And so with that, Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, appreciate the time. I will send to the whole committee that really exhaustive product that the Brady Work Group worked through. I think it's really good work. The Brady Work Group continues to take on new issues. We continue to have concerns because there are officers that once they're on a Brady list, or there's another term of art called a no confidence list. No confidence list would be something that doesn't raise to a Brady requirement, but the DA may have decided, I am not going to call this officer to testify. And when that is the decision, now you have an officer that can't work cases. And so not everybody came out of this work group, or everybody came out of this work group not fully satisfied. There's issues that we're continuing to work on. What does an officer do? We've tried to improve the whole right to challenge when things are allegated. But we still have officers that are at a place where they cannot do the work of a police officer because they cannot be called to court and cannot be used as a witness in the cases that they work. And that continues to be an ongoing problem for officers, agencies, and district attorneys. And so, Mr. Chair, those are my concerns, and I appreciate deeply the time to testify.
Mike.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Silvaggio from the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. This bill is not it's not ours. However, we did submit testimony supporting the original version, and I wanted to make it clear that we also continue to support the version as would be amended, removing subsections L and N as described. It's our understanding that the definition of impeachment list on page one of the bill is going to include not just lists per se, but also various other systems and records that could include letters. And it's our assertion that I think I agree with what my colleague is describing, in that the mere appearance on a list, we don't want to see the third party of the prosecutor's office be able to impose discipline through that means. However, the underlying reason that an officer is on a list is certainly within the purview of an agency to address as per their various policies and such. I think that I'll just leave it at that and say if there's any drafting issues, definitional issues that need to be worked out, we're thrilled to be involved in working those out pursuant to the intent of the bill.
All right, thank you. First, questions or comments from anyone? All right, I am going to put on the record, Kevin Campbell and I had an opportunity to talk outside before the hearing started. I am finding myself getting to the point of frustration as to, we have another work group that's been assigned to try to work this out. It's been at least 2 years from my calculation that it's been going on, and we're not getting results. We need results. The bottom line, we cannot just continue to have these groups facilitate and not come to some resolution. And I find it very disheartening that you have an individual has an allegation brought up against them. There's no due process for that individual to be able to try to clear their name or not clear their name. And it just seems to me that for the profession, for the citizens of the communities that these officers work in, we need to figure out what the actual end game is And then if they're not able to testify because they're not truthful, they should be out. If they and it just seems to me what I've heard is that some you have these individuals who get on these lists, and I did not even know about the no confidence list compared to the Brady list, and then they're basically on a desk job and they can't really be a full sworn officer anymore because they will never be in court. And so it just seems to me we need to get off the dime. So I'm not sure where the work group is, how quickly they're going to be moving through this, but I would like to have a report back, if possible, by the end of next week. So, Kevin, I know this isn't your task, but
all
if
right,
you could,
it's fine.
Is like Dinah may be able to give me, or did you want to give me a comment or two?
Mr. Chair, she's coming up. I would like to send you the kind of product that the work group put together. Like I said, there's still additional issues, but there was some significant progress made in terms of process that the district attorneys have actually approved, which increases the level of process for the officer, which is significant to us from the law enforcement agency leadership perspective. We don't want officers going on a Brady list unless it's clear they should be. And so I think it was the work group was excellent. I would love to send you the product of that. I just think their work is not done. They need to continue to work. And I share your frustration. I know there's agencies and officers both that are kind of stuck in situations where they're on. So. No.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. Dinah Vitalens, Crook County District Attorney. The protocol and process that was developed by the Brady Group is really excellent because the issue is, as a district attorney, I have both a constitutional as well as an ethical obligation to make sure that I provide to the defense or to the defendant all exculpatory information, and so that includes anything that involves an officer. And traditionally, we've never offered any due process to an officer because we felt it was our individual decision and our tickets were on the line, as well as the seriousness of our oath to uphold the Constitution. We would generally just do that without any due process. The new Brady process is, and I had a recent case where I was, unfortunately, first time in my career where I had to do that. I received three police reports that clearly demonstrated that the officer had engaged in dishonesty. I put those allegations in a letter, sent the letter to the officer, and said, within 7 days, you may come and meet with me. We can discuss this, and I'll make my final decision. Not a lot of due process, but more than I think we were doing before. And after that, I met with the officer, invited him to bring his attorney, and then I made my decision and communicated that to the chief of police. And so that's the good part of the Brady process. And you've hit the nail on the head in terms of the rub between what I take as my independent ethical constitutional duty versus the rights of the police officers. And I do think that the good work that the Brady Group has done, and everybody's invested in that, could continue to work on this issue, although, frankly, I don't know if we'll ever agree.
So let me just ask. I mean, I'm very appreciative of getting the update and understanding there's due diligence being done and everyone seems to still be at the table, and that's great. But at some point, we need to do something. And in the sense that we need to, I'm going to say, bring it at least to temporary closure, understanding it may have to be reopened later. So I would like to get this information this next week if possible, and then we can make an assessment as to what we need to do, with, if anything, on 743 now, or any other thing that kind of goes into this group, or set some other timeline so everyone understands, has the expectation that the legislature is ready to move forward, and we're going to put a date as to when we're going to do that.
And Mr. Chair, I will get that full report to all of the members of the committee and council as soon as I can get to my computer and send it. So you'll have that, and then I'd love to follow up, meet with any of you in order to discuss what you think are appropriate next steps. I do know this work group is poised to continue to work, and so if there are specific challenges that you'd like to see them specifically take on with a requirement to come back to you with something tangible. I know they're willing to do that, so whatever your direction is on that, we'll work to make it happen.
That'd be great. Thank you all very much for coming forward.
Thank you.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on 743. And at this point, we're going to drop down to Senate Bill 397. And on this one here, this is a work session. I'm opening up that work session with the gavel. And I had recessed kind of sort of this bill when we had it before. If you remember, I believe it was February 18th that we had the bill before. And first of all, let me just have Jeff kind of give us a reminder of what we're talking about, then I'll give my statements.
Certainly. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, Senate Bill 397 originally came to us from the Senate Interim Committee, and the bill as introduced increases the fees for driving under influence of intoxicants, diagnostic assessments, and screening interviews from $150 to $275. We do have proposed Dash 1 amendments which replace the bill in its entirety. The Dash 1 amendments define negative report and allow the Department of Transportation to further define test violations by rule for interlock ignition devices. The bill's amendments state that when a defendant is participating in a DUI diversion, the provider who installed the interlock device must notify the court or the court's designee and the district attorney or city prosecutor of a negative report within 7 business days. The amendments state that the negative report notification must be in a format that is prescribed by the Department of Transportation. They provide that a person may not have an ignition interlock device removed unless they demonstrate 90 days without a negative report. For a person participating in diversion, however, they may petition the court for removal of an ignition interlock device after 6 consecutive months without a negative report. And lastly, the amendments provide that the court or agency may not charge a defendant an additional fee to pay costs incurred by an agency or organization in carrying out their duties.
All right. So we had this bill, as council said, on the 18th of February. That was the day that Governor Brown was sworn in. And if you remember, we had a time frame for everyone to try to get to the floor. We got close to the end of that time frame, and a few of us got a little more anxious of wanting to get down to the floor a little quicker than maybe we needed to, but whatever that case may be. We asked the remaining witness, which was Gail Meyer, if she wanted to go ahead and give her testimony then, knowing that she had lost at least 2 of the members of the committee. And she said no, she'd like to wait until it could get rescheduled for that purpose. We have moved forward to the work session here. And then yesterday I received an email from Sally Pena, and I'm Sally, you're here. And she was basically under the impression that that this was going to be left open for a full public hearing. I reviewed the video last night, and clearly I had stated on the record, I asked if there was anyone else who wanted to give testimony on that. There was 2 bills that we had open at the time, 397 and 398, for public hearing. No one said they wanted to do so. But because of, let's say, whatever perception and confusion, I've agreed as the chair to allow Ms. Pena to have a moment to say what she might want to capture on the record. So if you want to come forward, we'll take your testimony, then we'll come back and take Gail Myers.
Good morning, Senator Prezansky, or Chairman Prezansky, and members of the committee. I'm grateful to have an opportunity to testify this morning, Chairman, but I do have an objection to the fact that continued public testimony wasn't allowed. I'm naive about the process, but to me...
First of all, I need you to give me your name.
Oh, okay. My name is Sally Pena, and I'm an ATIS over in Polk County.
All right, and Ms. Pena, if you have an issue regarding the procedure that I used, there's a process that you can take that to the President's office.
Okay.
What I'm trying to do is give you the opportunity to give testimony. As I stated, the video is very clear that I asked from this dais whether anyone wanted to give testimony. If you were in the room, you did not acknowledge that you wanted to give testimony. And my comments were that we were going to carry this over for Ms. Meyer to be able to have her opportunity because she was on the list. And because we had an important engagement,
I was losing members, and that's why I've just decided to use my prerogative to allow you to give your testimony on the bill. Now, I understand the bill has changed to dash one. You will find that in the procedure of how this body works, meaning the legislature, it is very common that bills that are introduced may be changed significantly in the process. And at that point, there does not require a new public hearing based on whatever amendments have been adopted. Mm-hmm. So if you want to give us testimony on either the original bill or on the dash ones, we're more than willing to hear that at this time.
Thank you for that clarification. I appreciate it. I'd like to begin by asking the committee to not act on the amended version of this bill, but rather to either reinstate the original bill or to vote against the amendment. And the reason that I would like to do that is because I think that this bill essentially guts the job of the ATIS in the state of Oregon. I'd like to begin by telling you what an ATIS does. First of all, we've served the state of Oregon well for over since 1981. We're an integral part of the DUII system, which has helped to keep Oregon recidivism rates among the lowest in the country. We're designated by our local courts and certified by the Oregon Health Authority. We provide a number of services. We meet with the offender to complete an evaluation and assessment initially to determine whether the client is appropriate for treatment or education. We act in collaboration with the offender to determine which program they're going to attend. We obtain signed releases to the program and the courts from the client so that we can communicate with those entities. We notify the court of the referral, advise the court of the name of the program so the court is aware that the process has begun. We monitor the client's progress throughout their program, keeping the court advised of any failures to attend or failures in terms of sobriety. We keep statistics on every client for OHA, which we're required to submit. We also transfer clients who, for a variety of reasons, need to change programs. We provide Department of Motor Vehicle certificates to out-of-state treatment agencies for them to file in Oregon so conviction clients can get their license back at some point. We do re-referrals to clients who have been non-complied and the court has sent back to us for a continuation of monitoring. We're required to maintain our files for 7 years. We maintain office facilities consistent with OHA administrative rules. And sometimes, like today, we have to individually come as naive ATISes to testify because we have no lobbyist. Our office expenses are substantial, and we receive not $1, not one dime of public funding at all to do the jobs that we do. We're completely reliant on the fees that are paid to us by the defendant. Throughout the state, we're subsidizing DUII offenders for some time. Rent, utilities, salaries, insurance, taxes, supplies, maintenance, telephones, internet costs are all increasing, and the legislature has failed to raise our fee in the past 11 years. So we're trying to act with budgets that are 11 years old in terms of funding at 2014 expense rates. This bill, as it is amended, will provide no increase at all to the ATIS. We will be also forced to take away some of the fee increases that some of the courts have allowed the ATISes to charge because of the fact that our fees have not been raised, and we've been also added the additional burden in some courts of monitoring people for their ignition interlock device reports. After the 2013 legislative session, many ATISes, such as myself, were appointed by the courts to be the recipient of those ignition interlocks reports. No fee was allowed in that bill. Some courts, facing the absurdity of having to ask their ATISes to work for nothing, monitor for the ignition interlock devices, assume the liability for that monitoring for free, and in that absurdity resulted the court's request and order in some courts to have a fee imposed, but that the defendant would pay in order to cover the cost of the ATIS doing that work. This bill, as amended, would not only eliminate those fees that the court has already ordered, it would in the future forbid any court from ordering a fee to monitor for the ignition interlock reports or for anything else. Some courts, out of desperation, because again, the legislature has not acted to raise our fee, some treatment courts have allowed the ATIS, not in my courts, but in other courts, to charge, for example, referrals, transfers, things that are not included in our job as an ATIS by statute, but which in reality have become a part of our job because of the nature of what is required. Senator Barnhart testified on this bill, and he had some concerns. His suggestion was is that the ATIS position be eliminated. And I would ask Senator Barnhart, if I had a chance, who...
For the record, he's a representative.
I'm sorry, Representative Barnhart. I would ask him why he is keeping... He has maintained a position that ATIS should be eliminated. I don't know if I were to ask him what his answer would be.
If you listen to his testimony, I think he's very clear as to why he thought the ATIS's positions needed to be redefined.
Yes, and I'm going to address that. But what it's not clear to me as what he would intend to replace the ATIS with.
And, you know, the reality at this point, that's not something for our committee as to what Representative Barnhart has given his testimony, you're giving your testimony, and what the two of you work out or come to an agreement is between
okay.
the two of you.
Well, perhaps I shouldn't have personalized it with Senator Barnhart, but the question that I would raise, irregardless of his position, is who does replace the ATIS? If we're eliminated, who does replace the ATIS? Other issues that have been raised is that the $150 presents a barrier to treatment. That simply is not true. Anybody in the state of Oregon who has serious addiction issues at any time can go to any mental health agency that deals with addiction issues where their insurance is covered and ask to enter into the program. But the reality is the clients that we deal with don't voluntarily enter into the program. They've committed a criminal act and they're being mandated into treatment, not because they want to go, but because they're being mandated. And unless there's someone to back up that mandate of the court to verify that that defendant is in fact following through with the court's obligation, then the system doesn't work very well to protect the public. Because if the ATIS isn't there to help monitor for the court, those defendants and the public defenders will love this bill because there's no one to tell the court this client is not doing what they're supposed to do. If the ATIS position does not exist and a client goes into court as a DUI offender, where does the court send this client? Do they send them to a treatment agency and hope that at some point, despite the fact that the court has no releases, that they're going to find out the status of this client? Do they send them to a correction facility, a corrections office, which can deal with some cases but not all? I'm not sure where this client ends up. The ATIS has served a worthwhile, important part of the process for many, many years. If, however, finances are a barrier to people getting into treatment, our $150 fee is a barrier, then the state has an option. There is the Intoxicated Drivers Fund, which is paid for by the defendant as part of their filing fees for conviction clients. That money could easily be accessed, and ATISes have requested that it be accessed in the past. But instead of accessing that fund, the state itself, OHA, has refused to allow that funding to be released to us. If there's a barrier to treatment, that is one of the solutions, but I don't think the barrier is significant. Finally, there are arguments being made that ATISes are not qualified. I would remind the committee that ATIS must meet legislative qualifications with the court. ATISes must meet administrative rule qualifications set up by Oregon Health Authority. If this body does not think that we're qualified to do our work, then they certainly have the opportunity to increase our qualifications. But I would challenge this committee to compare the qualifications of the ATISes that are working for the courts and designated by the courts with treatment providers, and I think you will be surprised at that comparison. Finally, if there is concern about an ATIS that is acting inappropriately, of which I have no knowledge of any ATISes in that situation, but if there is evidence of that, either the court can immediately remove designation, or Oregon Health Authority can begin a process that doesn't take long to get rid of that person. So those bad eggs that are found in any arena of work in the world can be eliminated much easier with the ATISs than if that those actions were taken by a public employee.
But Sally, you've said finally twice now, so I do need to wrap up.
I'm sorry. I'm moving quickly as I can. Well, but this is the only opportunity that anyone who is...
Sally, you have 1 minute to conclude your statements. We've given you an opportunity to put some stuff on. I have other people I need to bring forward to go through testimony.
I appreciate that, and I'll hurry. It also, the allegations are also that we're not trained. It is the Oregon Health Authority's mandate, and they have funding to train us. If training is not happening, it's on Oregon Health Authority as a result. I strongly urge you, and there are no other ATISs in this or courts that will have an opportunity to testify on this bill because of the process the bill has been presented.
Actually, if you look at the record, we've already had an ATIS from Clackamas County who came and gave
who strongly objects to this amended
version. Who gave excellent testimony.
Yes. Teresa was here, and I've talked to her. She strongly objects to the amended version.
Please conclude your statement.
Okay. In light of this, I'm strongly asking this committee to not pass this amended version of the law. The only reason that I get to testify is because of fluke in the process. Otherwise, this bill would have gone through the committee without any input from the people that are most fiscally, as well as any other fiscally impacted. Many of the ATIS's offices will close if this bill passes. We had no opportunity except for a fluke in process to testify at all.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, I'll be glad to take them.
We'll see if we have any. Any questions? Don't think so. Thank you very much. Gail, I think you were scheduled to testify next, and then we'll have the department come up, and we'll talk about the fiscals. And
Thank you, Chair Przonski, members of the committee. Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I will confine my remarks to the Dash 1 amendment, if I might address it. Thank you. I read it quickly last night, and I will confess I'm not 100% confident I have all the feedback I would enjoy having before I make my remarks. But two things for the chair to consider. I don't know if you're willing. If you want to move the bill today, I can
chase
that. We're
not moving the bill today.
Okay.
We're working on the fiscals.
Okay. Thank you. With respect to just section, we like the bill. We think the bill makes huge, great improvements in so many respects. The opportunity to do a motion to vacate the IID requirement, all that. We thank the chair for structuring the bill as the amendment as you have. Two requests, two thoughts. Number one, section two. Where does the notice of the negative report go? The retain bar would very much like to have the copy of the negative report sent to the defense counsel as well. So that is a request. The other thing is a little bit more detailed, and that's Section 8. Section 8 would allow ODOT to suspend a license for failure to submit proof of the installation of an IID. That doesn't bother so much. It would also allow ODOT to suspend a license, however, for a tampering with an ignition interlock device after it had been installed. Our concern on Section 8 with respect to the tampering is that we don't see the process by which there would be an evidentiary opportunity to contest whether a tampering had in fact occurred. I'm told that sometimes those are disputed issues. The printout may read a tamper, and there's an evidentiary dispute as to whether or not the machine didn't just go wacko, because sometimes it can just have multiple tamperings. And this may clear up with cameras on IDs. I don't know. But as Section 8 is drafted, it would allow ODOT to conclude a tampering, suspend, and then you'd have a right of an administrative review, but which would all be on paper. You'd never have the right for an evidentiary hearing. So I don't really have a suggestion to the chair on how we would structure this, but that's the concern.
All right. Thank you. Any other comments at this
No.
point? No. Is there any questions or comments for Gail? Thank you very much
Thank
for coming
you.
Forward. Amy, I know you're here. I'm not sure if you're coming up on your own. Yeah, we definitely want you to come up because we're going to talk the fiscal. We understand it just came in and also just concern. So we want you to kind of walk us through that because
I'll say sticker shock is definitely here.
Right. Chair Pozanski and members of the committee, Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation. First, if I can just quickly address Gail Meyer's comments. I believe the concern she raised in Section 8 is actually existing law, and it shows up in Section 8 because it's been moved through Council's redrafting of this portion of the statute. So I'll just put that on the record. In terms of the fiscal, the vast, vast majority of the fiscal comes from Section 3, the requirement for a 90 days clean blow before you can be done with your ignition interlock. The reason for the large fiscal, as many in this body have heard me talk about before, is because of computer programming issues. So today, when a person has an ignition interlock requirement under existing law, there's a hard end date. You know, September 2nd of 2016 is the day the ignition interlock comes off, and the computer processes these things. It kind of gets automatically put in there because the computer knows it's a one-year IID requirement or a two-year IID requirement. That goes into the system that way. The system will now need to be changed so that all of these suspensions become non-specific ending dates. And because
let's just stop there. Why would we need to program for all of them to be non-ending date as compared to having a date that's specific as it is today, and then making whatever modifications based on a case-by-case basis?
So, Chair Pozanski, I believe the answer to this, and I will correct myself afterwards if I find out I'm wrong. I believe the answer is this is the concept of humans make errors and computers tend not to make errors. So the system, in all the many ways that DMV imposes suspensions and lifts suspensions, it's all very automated, and it prevents human beings from making mistakes and allowing, for instance, a reinstatement when they shouldn't be granting a reinstatement. So things are hard-coded into the computer to prevent people from doing things in error that violate the law. And if I'm wrong about that answer, I will get back to you.
That doesn't really quite answer my question. Okay. Let's just go through an example. Okay. They have the IID requirement for 1 year.
Yeah.
It's hard copied or coded into, and 1 year it's supposed to come out. If there's going to be any modification of that, it's going to come through a court order, meaning a court's going to grant something that they're going to send paperwork to DMV to then have an adjustment made. And I understand there's this protocol of how the court can't really order this, but they give notice that this is supposed to happen, and then DMV is supposed to respond to that. So I guess just anecdotally, I don't see every one of these needing to be modified or changed. It's only going to be those who meet the criteria or fail to meet the criteria, because I think Section 3 is the one where they have to be clean for 90 days prior to that. So if everything is coded for 1 year, it would seem from my perspective that the court is going to give notice that someone isn't compliant, and that suspension should not be lifted at that time.
So, Chair Pozanski, let me make sure I understand. I think what you're saying then is that the presumption would be that the person has completed their 90 days clean by the end of the, let's take the 1 year example. So their 1 year ends, that the presumption will be that they have had 90 days clean, and only if there's a court order that the court would send to DMV saying, nope, they haven't done it, don't let them reinstate, then we would do something to prevent the person from reinstating. That is, if that's what you're saying, that is not how we understood the bill. We understand the bill to be person walks into the field office to reinstate, they've at least reached the 1 year, and they have to bring in a certificate from the provider saying, and I have had 90 days clean certified by the provider.
Okay.
So it's all the customer, the offender, producing information. So,
all right. So let's just go with that. Is that the interpretation? So, how is that causing so much chaos in the programming? Because it's already hard copied. I guess I can see what you're maybe saying is that until you get that certificate, you think that the records need to basically show you're going to be suspended until you come in and show that that clean record.
Chair, that's correct.
Okay. All right. Go ahead.
That's really all I have, Chair. I will tell you the vast, vast majority of our admittedly large fiscal is found in Section 3. Without Section 3, it would be an extremely different situation.
Right. So now that we've got kind of the context, doesn't the defendant have to come in to activate reinstatement?
Chair, yes, they do.
So when they come in after a year, if they don't have that certificate from the provider of the IID, why would you need to reinstate, or why or how would you reinstate?
I'm sorry, Chair, I don't think I understand the question.
So basically, they're just because they get the suspension and it's for 1 year. After that 1 year has gone, the record for DMV is going to say eligible for reinstatement, is what I'm assuming based on what I've seen on DMV records.
Mm-hmm.
But before they are able to actually have it reinstated, they come in, they pay a fee to be reinstated,
mm-hmm.
and it would seem at that point they would have to be with the certificate stating, I've been clean for 90 days. And if they don't have that, they don't have all the paperwork they need to be reinstated.
Thank you, Chair. Two things. First, I'm pretty sure I was misspeaking when I said reinstate the suspension, and I think what I should have been saying is remove the ignition interlock requirement on the record, because that's really what we're talking about. They're already out of suspension at that point. They've got the ignition interlock. They have driving privileges. So it's the time period at which they no longer need an ignition interlock. So there's that. The second piece, which I think was your actual question, which was they've got to bring in these things. So you either...
I understand that. So our term of art is not correct as to suspensions for this, because... But at the same time, there's a obligation that they keep the IID in their vehicle for a set period of time. Once that set period of time has run, do they not have to come back into the DMV to do something to remove that from their record that they had that obligation?
So, Chair Pozanski, under the existing law, the requirement falls off the record on a set date. So, and I apologize, I think I might be getting myself wrapped around the proverbial axle, but the issue is, under existing law, there's a set end date and on the ignition interlock requirement. So that's the thing that's just falling off the record. So one day it's required, the next day the computer tells the record it's no longer required, and that's the kind of record that a law enforcement officer can see. Under the Dash 1 amendment, what will then be happening is the person's going to have to come in with their proof that they have had their 90 days to get it actively lifted. So you've got the system where it's not going to automatically drop off. You're going to just wait until at least 1 year, but then also coming in and showing the proof to get the requirement lifted from the record. So that's the systems piece, and then also people coming into the office to do things.
Okay. Senator Thatcher, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I guess I would have.
I just assume you might.
I was always confused about why this. Yeah, I think we've had conversations about this. Would not the section where they can petition for an early, in the term of bar here, I'm getting hung up on that, but, you know, after 6 months of clean blows, if they go to the judge and they can opt tell them that they can have that removed, wouldn't that also be in the same category as the 90-day? Okay. And
yeah, I mean,
yeah, that's a very good question.
Well, I think on both ends it's going to be, I mean, basically what we're saying is that maybe what we need to be looking at is how DMV codes this in the initial part. Maybe if we're going to actually move this forward, it does stay open, and then it does take an affirmative act.
Right.
I mean, either way, I mean, it just seems to me that you're probably going to have more, I don't think I need to anecdotally say you're going to have more of the failures or those that are successful in getting them off earlier, but it just seems to me that the process that DMV is now currently using, they just put a set date in and they just take it off automatically no matter what the success or failure of the individual has been with the IID.
And the expense goes back to the coding because of their computer system being so antiquated, and it always goes back to that.
Yeah, it's been there for 20 years.
I know, or more.
That's true.
Yes.
They're still DOS, aren't they?
No, COBOL.
No, Fortran 4, I
COBOL.
Think. Or BASIC.
That would be new. I think they're COBOL.
Yeah. All right. Any other comments or statements you'd like to make, Amy?
You know, I think there, you know, maybe one or two technical things in the bill that if the 90 days clean blow were to remain in there, it encompasses hardship permits, and there is one hardship permit that doesn't even last 90 days. So, you know, that may be something worth discussing as the process moves forward, since I think I heard you say, Chair, that you're not going to move the bill today. So,
well, yeah, we're not. Well, we just got the fiscal, but we're not moving it today because I think the $459,247 is high. Okay. I just think, it's a point that we're going to look to see what we can do, and I want some more justification as to this amount. It just seems like, I'll be very frank with the agency, it just seems like there's a lot of work that we try to do, and all of a sudden there's this, you know, six-figure number that's all of a sudden just on here. And we're trying to figure out why and how we can make changes. And I don't think it's as simple as having a new computer system. Other questions, comments, frustrations, or anything else?
I would recommend that ODOT not try to hook into MMIS, so that would be.
Amy, thank you very much.
I don't even know what that is, Chair.
Thank you very much for coming forward.
Thank you very much.
All right.
Well, I have comments on the bill, but not necessarily for ODOT. Yep. I do have concerns still about the removal after talking to the judge after 6 months, only because the studies indicate that recidivism does increase after removal of the device. Now, if you're going to go ahead and do this, which I think you are, is there a way that we could track that population as far as recidivism goes, to kind of maybe put a pilot on it or something to kind of go back and revisit it and say this is working or maybe we need to adjust it?
They'll still be in diversion under the jurisdiction of the court.
Yeah, they're still going to, remember the diversion period is for 1 year. No matter what program you go into, it could be a 16-week program, a 12-week, a three-month program, whatever it is. Okay. That's just part of the diversion period of 1 year. So for someone to, let's say, be, you know, really successful, really quick, they're still in the diversion for 6 months or, let's say, 5 months. And I don't know how each court does, but I know one of the courts I work with, they actually have the person scheduled to come in two or three times during that period to ensure they're on track. That's how this court does. Mm-hmm. They don't. It's not that they don't use ATISs, but they, in fact, basically have an accountability of requiring that defendant to come in unless they have shown, demonstrated that they are in on schedule, in treatment, et cetera.
So just because they've had their IID removed does not mean that they're just scot-free? They're just
absolutely not. No,
okay,
absolutely
so they're still accountable to whatever the requirements are, additional requirements.
Absolutely, and if you remember, one of the provisions is they have to be in complete compliance with their treatment. I mean, for the judge to even consider allowing that to occur. And so, I mean, I feel, based on my experience, that there's still a lot of checks and balances. Mm-hmm. It just seems to me that
if we're going to, and we should, hold people accountable to make certain that they're actually don't have all these failures and that they are going to realize that, you know, you can't just wait out your 1 year and then you're going to get your license back because the obligation goes away. It just seems to me in a incentive-based process, if we can get people to get with the program and get successful with the program quicker than maybe they might in other ways, that's a, as we heard previously, a carrot that helps that system work, I think, even more, let's say, better than what it currently does, because it does, in fact, allow for accountability and for assurance that if you are accountable, that you're going to potentially get some benefit from that. So okay. We're going to still work on this.
All right. Well, no, I like that. There are really good parts of the bill I do appreciate. So
yeah. We'll see about the Section 3.
All right.
Anything else? All right. So that's going to take care, I believe, what we had for 397. I'll go ahead and close that. We do have one other bill that I want to just real quickly was 526, Senate Bill 526. Open the work session on that. Gail, I'd like for you to please come forward on that. I'm going to make a statement on 526. We asked for some amendments to be drafted, which are there. Unfortunately, I did not articulate what I really wanted to ensure was going to be included in those amendments, so we are having them redrafted or will be having them redrafted. And, Gail, you brought up a couple points, and one of the things I had said during the hearing, I was very concerned about physical injury being opened up to minor cuts, and such, like a paper cut and stuff like that. That did not get caught into the amendment. And then you brought up the concern of with vulnerable people. It's really a two-part test, and it looks like we lifted the first part but not the second part. And my intent would be to maintain what we require now under law as to competency for people to testify. Is there, Donna, you're here. I don't know if you want to come up. You can sit there if you want. If you want to say anything, come on up. If you just want to listen, Gail, whatever you have, if I haven't covered it, that's what we're going to be trying to capture, and we're going to make certain both of you are engaged in this to make certain we get the language right.
Thank you. Chair Przonski, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to just make some notes of this. If the committee recalls, this really comes up from the instance of the case, State versus Wright, with the bruising. Thank you. Gail Meyer, on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. Good to meet you, Senator Cruz. Thank you. The hearing came up in the posture of this appellate case, State versus Wright, and that was the little 16-year-old minor kid with the bruising on the buttocks. 16 months. Thank you. Did I say year? I'm sorry. 16-month-year-old little kid who was unable to articulate the level of pain he experienced from the spankings that resulted in the bruises. And that's really the focus, I think, of the amendment, is to broaden the issue of physical injury in instances when you have a witness who it could be from dementia, it could be from a delayed, developmental delay, or youth is simply unable to articulate. So we were hoping to get the amendment focused on that population. As it's currently drafted, it just incorporates age differences, so under 18 or over 65. But you could be pretty capable of articulating at 17 and 67, and so we think it should be further constrained.
Okay.
Chair Przonski, members of the committee, Dinah Vidalins here on behalf of the Oregon District Attorneys Association and as Crook County District Attorney. We very much like the Dash 3 proposed amendment in terms of the population it protects, which are minors, elders, and then victims of domestic violence. And that's basically the State versus Lewis case where ripping hair out of a victim's head was found not to be physical injury by the Court of Appeals. The one thing I'd mention in terms of paper cuts and things like that. This definition of physical trauma is currently the definition for animal abuse cases. And so you don't see prosecutors charging animal abuse if there's a paper cut on the chihuahua or it's got to be a significant thing. This essentially continues our ability to hold people accountable for assaults on children and elders and domestic violence victims. And so I'd ask that you support the Dash 3 amendments.
Okay.
We're over time.
Okay.
My committee's been very gracious with their time today, so okay. We're going to be working on it, so it's not a done deal.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on this bill, which is 526. And I think that concludes our work for today. We're not going to be meeting tomorrow since we're not on the floor. Monday, I think we're still, I can't remember if we went to an 8:30. We didn't go to 8:30. Senator Burdick? At 8:30, that's half past 8 o'clock, not 8 o'clock. With that, we're adjourned. Everyone have a good day. Adjourned. Everyone have a good day. With that, we're